This Week with George Stephanopoulos starts right now.
Insurrection fallout.
They have made statements and taken actions that I think would impact the integrity of the commission.
Speaker Nancy Pelosi rejects two Trump loyalists from the January 6th commission.
Unless Speaker Pelosi reverses course and seats all five Republicans, we will not participate.
As senators race to reach a bipartisan infrastructure deal.
Do you think it's going to move forward in the Senate on Monday?
I do.
We cover it all with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Republican Senator Rob Portman, both This Week exclusives. And
the people more brazen in carrying their weapons?
I don't think there's any doubt.
As homicide rates spike to the highest level in decades, our exclusive ABC News investigation chronicles a week of gun violence in America. Plus,
if you are not vaccinated, please take the Delta variant seriously. This virus has no incentive to let up.
COVID infections surge across the country. Should vaccines and masks now be mandated? That debate on our Powerhouse Roundtable.
From ABC News, it's This Week. Here now, George Stephanopoulos.
Good morning and welcome to This Week. As we come on the air this morning, President Biden has hit the six-month mark in office, holding majority support from the American people. Our brand new poll with Ipsos also shows that 52% of Americans believe that Biden is following through on his campaign promises. But it also shows that most Americans are pessimistic about the year ahead, a dramatic 20-point swing from optimism in May as the country faces an array of challenges, a resurgent coronavirus, rising crime, inflation, our politics as divided as ever. We're going to address it all this morning, and we begin with the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. Madam Speaker, thanks for joining us this morning. And I want to start with the January 6th Commission, the investigation that you have launched in the House. I know that this came about because the Republicans rejected a bipartisan independent commission, also rejected a Senate commission as well. But your decision to reject Congressman Jim Jordan and Jim Banks from the committee has drawn fire from Republicans. The Freedom Caucus is seeking to depose you as Speaker, and Liz Cheney is now the only Republican member of the committee. Are you concerned about the Freedom Caucus threat? And are you confident that the committee's work can be seen as credible if most Republicans won't participate?
Well, thank you. First of all, thank you for the opportunity to be with you this morning. We have many challenges, and it's my honor to discuss them with you. First of all, no, I'm not concerned about any threat from the Freedom Caucus. We get those every day of the week. Our confidence that we have in the work of our bipartisan committee that we have now, Select Committee, led by Chairman Benedict Thompson, bipartisan with the participation of a very courageous member of Congress, Congresswoman Liz Cheney, is high. My confidence is high. I do believe that the work of this committee, in order to retain the confidence of the American people, must act in a way that has no partisanship, is all about patriotism. And I'm very proud of the members of the committee, and I'm certain that they will accomplish that goal. We have to, again, ignore the antics of those who do not want to find the truth. We will find the truth. That truth will have the confidence of the American people because it will be done patriotically and not in a partisan way.
Will you be appointing more Republicans to the committee like Congressman Adam Kinzinger?
That would be my plan.
So when will that be announced?
Perhaps after I speak to Adam Kinzinger. But I'm not about to announce it right this minute. But you could say that that is the direction that I would be going on. He and other Republicans have expressed an interest to serve on the Select Committee. And I wanted to appoint three of the members that Leader McCarthy suggested, but he withdrew their names. The two that I would not appoint are people who would jeopardize the integrity of the investigation. And there's no way I would tolerate their antics as we seek the truth.
Even relatively moderate Republicans like Senator Portman, who's my next guest, have said your decision will fuel even more division in the country. Are you worried at all by this precedent that Republicans will do the same thing when they are next in power?
No. But we have had an unprecedented action, an assault, an insurrection against our government, an assault on the Capitol building, which is an assault on the Congress, on a day that the Constitution required us, by the Constitution, to validate the work of the Electoral College. So this was not just any day of the week. This was a constitutionally required day of action for Congress. So the Republicans will say what they will say. Our Select Committee will seek the truth. It's our patriotic duty to do so. And we do not come into our work worried about what the other side, who has been afraid of this, maybe the Republicans can't handle the truth. But we have a responsibility to seek it, to find it, and in a way that retains the confidence of the American people.
Senator Portman is also one of the negotiators around this proposed bipartisan infrastructure deal. They expect a deal this week, but are you sticking by your decision to hold any vote on that deal until after the Senate passes a much larger infrastructure package through reconciliation?
Yes. Let me just say, as I respond to you, I hope that they will pass the bipartisan legislation. Infrastructure has always been bipartisan for all the years that I've been in the Congress. They diminished the bill when President Obama was president, but nonetheless, a bill was passed, the leadership of Senator Barbara Boxer, working with Senator Inouye in a bipartisan way. So I'm enthusiastic about the fact that they will have a bipartisan bill. I hope that it will be soon. But yes, I stand by, because the fact is that the president has said that he wants to have a bipartisan bill, and we all do. But that is not the limitation of the vision of the president. He wants to build back better. He wants to do so in a way that, again, involves many more people in the prosperity of our country. We say build back better with women. That's why we need child care. That's why we need home health care funding. That's why we need family and medical leave. So building the human infrastructure is really a part of building the physical infrastructure. So that's why we will have something further to add. The bill is not as green as I would like it to be, the infrastructure bill. And I think that it's something we could have passed a long time ago, even before the climate crisis was readily known to everyone. But nonetheless, I hope that it will pass. I won't put it on the floor until we have the rest of the initiative.
But if you stick by that decision, you could end up with nothing. Senator Lindsey Graham has threatened that Republicans will walk out of the Capitol if necessary to prevent any action on reconciliation, just like the Democrats did down in Texas.
Well, let me just say, you talk to Lindsey Graham about what he says. I'm telling you what's going to happen in the House of Representatives, and that is that we are rooting for the infrastructure bill to pass, but we all know that more needs to be done if we're going to build back better. And we're very proud of President Biden for the leadership that he has provided, taking us down this path, starting with the rescue package earlier in the spring, putting vaccines in the arms of American people, money in their pockets, children prepared to be safely back in school, many more people back in the workplace safely. And congratulations to him for his leadership on that, and I'm grateful to our members for their courage in putting that forth. The infrastructure bill is a very important step in building back, but we want to do it better, and that's what we intend to do.
It also means the Democrats might be forced to raise the debt limit on their own. You heard Senator McConnell this week say that it would have to be done through reconciliation. Republicans are not going to vote for it. Do you have the votes to raise the debt limit with Democrats alone?
Well, it's interesting about Senator McConnell. He raised the debt limit, had to be addressed three times under President Trump, and Democrats cooperated two of the times, and then the third time was just a change of the date. And it's so funny because he's always been there to be an obstruction to a Democratic president. The full faith and credit of the United States is never to be placed in doubt. It is in the Constitution, and it will be respected. With Republican obstinance in years gone by, even our credit rating was in question and reduced because of the question. Let there be no question. We will address the debt limit.
Finally, I do want to ask you about COVID. We're seeing this Delta variant sweep through the country right now. You've had some outbreaks in the House as well. Is it time to mask up again in the House, and will you be wearing your own mask more often?
Well, I wore my mask here, but as to whether we do so on the House floor, that is a decision of the House, the Capitol physician, and he will give us his recommendation about it. But let me once again praise President Biden. Right from the start, the president has been just on the job, making vaccine available in every nook and cranny of our country, available every place, urging people to be vaccinated. It's really important that that happen. And he has made that happen by having an abundance of a vaccines available for that. This is a vaccine, you know, I've been working on vaccines for a long time because of COVID. And this is a virus that is because of COVID, yes, but also because of HIV and AIDS. For 30 years, I've been working on that subject in the Congress. These viruses are very resourceful. They mutate, and they mutate by transmission. So if people will get vaccinated, there'll be less transmission, and therefore less mutation and less danger. But we are, I think, very well prepared to protect the American people. Let's just hope that they follow science. Some of these decisions are regional about requirements of masks and this or that. If you're asking me, I think that that we should mask, but in terms of officially for the House floor, that's up to the Capitol physician.
Madam Speaker, thanks for your time again this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you. Good morning.
Let's get a Republican response now from Senator Rob Portman of Ohio. Senator Portman, thanks for joining us this morning. Let's start out with that infrastructure deal. You just heard Speaker Pelosi say she's not going to have a vote until reconciliation is also passed by the Senate. First off, though, do you expect to reach a deal this week?
Well, George, let me say that what she has just said is entirely counter to what President Biden has committed to and what the Senate is doing, which is a two-track process. The infrastructure bill has nothing to do with the reckless tax and spend extravaganza that she's talking about in terms of what reconciliation, as she called it. So no, I'm not happy with what she said because it's inconsistent with the agreement that we have on a bipartisan basis.
Does that mean we'll end up with nothing?
Go on their own. Well, if she has her way, we could. I'm not sure what the future is of reconciliation. I know that the bipartisan infrastructure package is very popular among the American people and in the United States Congress because it makes sense. We need it badly. You know, 43% of our roads are in bad or mediocre condition, according to the engineers. 46,000 bridges are structurally deficient. We have ships lining up at ports because our ports aren't efficient enough. 87% of the American people think we should do a bipartisan infrastructure package. It's the right thing to do. Every president in modern times has talked about it. President Trump's proposal was for $1.5 trillion in infrastructure. Ours is about $579 billion over 5 years. So this is the right thing to do. It's been totally bipartisan from the start. It's the way we ought to be doing things here in Washington to get stuff done. And I can't believe the Speaker of the House would be blocking it.
Do you have a deal?
We're about 90% of the way there. I'm here this weekend working on legislative language with colleagues and with staff. And I feel good about getting that done this week. We have one issue outstanding, and we're not getting much response from the Democrats on it. It's about mass transit. Our transit number is very generous. We increased transit in this proposal. We also increased the formula going forward. That's the one issue that's outstanding, frankly, at this point. My hope is that we'll see progress on that yet today.
Wall Street Journal weighed in against the deal yesterday on their editorial page. I want to put it up on the screen right now. It says, taking the buy out of bipartisan. And they write, what's striking about the deal so far, however, is that by all appearances, this will be the most one-sided bipartisan deal in decades. They point out that the Republicans are not getting the kind of regulatory reforms you've called for. Also, you're not doing anything to stop that reconciliation package we were just talking about the Democrats hope to pass.
Well, you know, I normally respect the Wall Street Journal's editorial page. In fact, I read it every day, but they're totally wrong on this. And it shocks me that the Wall Street Journal, which has normally good journalistic ethics, would say in that editorial, we don't know what's in it, but this is what we think. In other words, they don't know what's in it. They're wrong about a number of things in there. If they had called and asked us, they could have avoided being wrong. One is they say that there's no permitting reform. There's historic permitting reform in this legislation, and they should strongly support that, as should every Republican and Democrat, by the way, because it allows the federal dollar to go further. Second, they say that it's not bipartisan. It's entirely I can guarantee you every single one of the issues has been bipartisan in the sense that there have been Republican views and Democrat views, and we found a way to find common ground, which is exactly what ought to happen. I think the editorial reflects the fact that this city, Washington, D.C., is not used to this. You know, we're building from the middle out and coming up with something that is truly bipartisan. Finally, they suggest that somehow this will be bad for the economy. It's good for the economy. Every economist that's looked at it says that. Why? Because you're investing in long-term capital assets. It's not immediate spending. It's not going to add to inflation. In fact, the economists will tell you it's just the opposite effect. As opposed to adding to demand, it adds to the supply side. This may be, you know, assets that last for 50, 70, 80 years, like the 43,000 structurally deficient, 46,000 structurally deficient bridges I talked about. So it's the right thing to do for the country, most importantly. But it's also something that has been the subject of a bipartisan consensus finding process, which we ought to do more of in this town.
Failing to raise the debt ceiling will threaten the economy. You heard Speaker Pelosi on that as well. Republicans voted three times to raise the debt ceiling under President Trump. Why not vote to raise it now?
Well, I think it's in the context of the reconciliation bill, which is unbelievable, George, at a time when we have incredibly high inflation, highest we've had probably in 20 years. And you look back at what they're proposing here, it is, you know, it's a huge new spending increase. At a time when we have unprecedented levels of debt, over $30 trillion soon, a $1 trillion deficit likely this year, and then the largest tax increase in American history. And these are tax increases that are not necessary. Right now, the Congressional Budget Office tells us that tax receipts, and this is the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, are going to be higher than anybody expected this year and next year. In fact, a 10% increase next year because the 2017 tax reform actually worked. It worked to stimulate economic growth. Going into the pandemic, we had the lowest poverty rate in the history of our country since we kept track of it in the 1950s. We had unbelievable increases in wages, over 3% annualized over the 19 months prior to COVID, and the lowest unemployment numbers ever for blacks, Hispanics, and 3.5% was the lowest in 50 years overall. So things were going well, and the economy is relatively resilient because of it. So let's not raise taxes right now. It'd be exactly
the failing to raise the debt ceiling will certainly threaten the economy.
Well, again, the debt ceiling has to be raised because of these tax and spend policies. And we need to ensure we get the spending under control. So typically when we do a debt ceiling, as you know, there's attached to it some restraint on spending. That's, you know, how
not under President Trump
spending over the last decade. Well, you know, under every president, there is a discussion of how you actually, if you're going to raise the debt ceiling, how do you use something to affect the debt, particularly the long-term debt of this country. And I think we ought to have that discussion.
Senator Portman, thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, George. Appreciate it.
Roundtable's coming up. Plus, as the homicide rate surges, Chief Justice Correspondent Pierre Thomas chronicles a week of gun violence in America. Stay with us.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Crime is down. Gun violence and murder rates are up. Guns. The people who, in fact, are using those weapons are acquiring them illegally. Here's the deal. Cops are having real trouble. They're not all bad guys. They're a lot of good guys. We need more policemen, not fewer policemen. but we need them involved in community policing.
There is President Biden addressing the epidemic of gun violence gripping America. And this week, ABC News teamed up with our partner stations across the country and the Gun Violence Archive to track shootings every day this week. Our chief justice correspondent, Pierre Thomas, has been tracking what's driving the surge and what can be done to stop it.
It should have been a celebration, the Bucks winning an NBA championship. Instead, gunshots. Chaos, people running for their lives.
Where do we go? Where do we go?
Part of the chronic gun violence epidemic surging in recent months. The map shows it all unfolding. More than 1,000 incidents, more than 430 dead, 1,000 wounded in 1 week.
3-2. Swing and a miss.
We saw it begin last Saturday.
8-4.
As we started our investigation. Gunshots outside of Nationals Park. That same night, a mother and her baby caught in the crossfire at a corner store in West Philadelphia, wounding the one-year-old.
I'm tired of this. I'm sick and tired of this.
Day after day, we saw so many children affected by this violence. One boy shot in a bedroom.
And the bullet just went through the wall, went through his head.
Tristan Jaden Rosas in San Antonio, Texas, was only 15 and playing video games, hit by a stray bullet.
I should have been there because when you promise a kid that you're going to protect them, that's a promise you can never take back.
Altogether, an unspeakable toll. More than 39 dead, 94 wounded under age 18, and of the deceased, 6 children under 12. We also saw mass shootings play out across the country, 18 incidents in 12 communities, including one that senselessly took the life of Corey Saunders and wounded 4 others.
Mass shootings are up a lot. They went from a 400 base in 2019 to 600, 700.
And sadly, we followed as reports of suspected domestic violence ticked up. At least 44 cases, among them a mother and child allegedly kidnapped Monday.
A female and her child was abducted and brought out here to Cheney Lake. At Cheney Lake, there was an altercation that occurred.
Virtually no area of the country was immune, but as ABC dug into the numbers, they showed violence disproportionately hit poor and urban areas.
People are afraid to go to malls. People are afraid to go to theaters. People are afraid to go to parks.
From Los Angeles to Chicago to New York, where this stunning video caught our attention. 2 men, guns drawn in broad daylight.
Are people more brazen in carrying their weapons? Has something shifted?
I don't think there's any doubt. But the data here in New York City is more guns on the scene of shootings, more rounds being fired.
New York City saw a 73% increase in shootings in May 2021 compared to the same time last year. On Tuesday, Commissioner Dermot Shea told us a lethal mix of factors is largely driving the surge. Gang violence, budget cuts, COVID shutting down the courts, leaving a backlog of more than 5,000 gun cases.
Taking the gun off the street is great, but really what we need is we need the individual carrying the gun off the street.
Increasing gun arrests and targeting repeat offenders has led to some signs of success. A dip in the rate last month. Shea remains unsatisfied.
Who are the victims?
When you look at who's getting shot in this city right now, it's about 97% people of color. It's way off the charts.
For Chief Judith Harrison, the fight is personal.
As an African American, obviously it was painful to hear that. He said 90% of your victims are people of color.
Yes. Horrifying statistic. But it's not just about statistics. It's not just about people of color. It's about everyone.
Philadelphia facing an even worse explosion.
It's been a minute since I've done this.
On Wednesday, Philly police allowing us to ride along. Small number of streets infected with gun violence.
We see this corner store out here. I'm going to come up in person. Okay. There were 6 people shot. So this is another corner here where we have multiple shootings.
The streets that night quiet until they weren't.
Now there's reports of shots fired at another end of the city.
A shooting outside this restaurant, famous for its cheesesteaks. That's a shell casing right on the ground right there. See where the white circle's drawn around it. I don't know what it is. You get closer to 2 o'clock, stuff starts popping. As we waited at the scene, the horrible news.
So he was pronounced deceased.
The person here?
Correct.
Died.
Correct.
That's horrible. Philadelphia Police Commissioner Danielle Outlaw telling us the argument was over a parking space.
A lot of the beefs or social media disputes or whatever, they're being resolved with the firearm.
Outlaw acknowledges the challenges of policing in the era of George Floyd and building community trust.
I'm a cop and I'm a black woman. And so because I have all of these lived experiences and these different perspectives, I understand why the police do what we do. But I also understand the hurt and the torment in our communities.
In so many neighborhoods, small numbers of repeat offenders terrorizing overwhelmingly law-abiding citizens.
I said, I'm shot. And then I felt the heat and my legs were all running away.
This Philly resident shot in the leg this week, along with another man standing in front of her home. She did not want to show her face on camera, at times tears filling her eyes.
I shouldn't have to be afraid to stay in my home.
At the end of a sobering week, we're left with the vigils.
Corey is looking down on us right now.
The lives lost, the families grieving, and the almost certain knowledge that next week it's all but guaranteed to happen again.
And Pierre Thomas joins us now. You just used the word sobering, and seeing this all in one place is about as sobering as can be.
George, I was struck by just the sheer concentration, so many children, the domestic violence, the mass shooting, 17 this week alone, where that's an incident where there are four or more people shot in basically one setting, 17 of those. It's difficult to absorb. And what we wanted to do was just take a look, to take a mirror and take a look at the country.
And this in some ways may be an undercount of the violence.
Oh, absolutely. These are conservative numbers. We did not account for gun death by suicide. Because those numbers are much more difficult. They're slower coming into the system. So according to our analysts, there would be hundreds more deaths in this number that we had this week.
So the big question is, how do we come to grips with this as a nation? What do we do about it?
George, I think at the end of the day, we have to answer a basic question. Are we okay with 1,400 people dying in a week? And it's going to happen again next week, over and over and over again.
If there's anybody out there willing to listen, get vaccinated.
The vaccines are terrific, you know, absolutely. They do a great job on this Delta variant.
It's time to start blaming the unvaccinated folks, not the regular folks. It's the unvaccinated folks that are letting us down.
These vaccines are saving lives. They are reducing mortality.
I would encourage people to get the vaccine. I have high confidence in it. I got it myself.
Striking course, Republicans calling for vaccines this week. I want to talk about that on our roundtable, joined by Chris Christie, Rahm Emanuel, Donna Brazile, and Margaret Hoover, host of Firing Line on PBS, also a CNN contributor. And Donna, we did see those Republican leaders this week calling for people to take the vaccines. But is it time to go farther? Is it time for vaccines to be mandated at major institutions?
I think so, George. Look, I'm eager to return back to campus this semester. We have a vaccine. We have a mask mandate. I've already had to show my card. We need to do everything possible to keep this country safe. I don't think we can afford to go back to that period of time when we were locked down and unable to get people back to work. So, yes, I hope we take it seriously. Look, I come from Louisiana. I was home 2 weeks ago wearing my mask, even walking my small dog. And people looked at me like I was strange. And I'm like, I don't want this. I don't want this virus.
No, it's about
the dog. Chris, no state was hit harder at the beginning than New Jersey.
No, look, we have the highest, and still do, have the highest death rate per capita of any state in the country. With all the lockdowns, with the biggest lockdown, probably New York and New Jersey were the biggest ones to lock down. It didn't work. The vaccines do work. And I think that every focus group I've been in with Republicans who are not vaccinated, you have to walk them through the logic of this. Right. What they don't want is to be indoctrinated. They're willing to be vaccinated. They don't want to be indoctrinated. And so let's be smart about this. And I think that one of the places where our leaders have fallen down is they're not explaining it. They're just saying, get vaccinated. And these folks do not respond to being ordered to do those things. I had a very smart guy who visited with me this week who said, I don't want the government telling me what I have to do. It's a libertarian type of response to this. But what they do respond to, I sat with this guy and I walked him through the facts. And then he said, okay, I'm going to go get vaccinated. That's what we need to be doing. So
when that guy's child goes to kindergarten, that guy has to present an immunization card that shows that his child is vaccinated. Right. So you know what? If we just made it really just almost impossible. If you're going to get government-provided health care, if you're getting VA treatment, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, anything, and Social Security obviously isn't health care, you should be getting the vaccine. Okay, because you're going to have to, we are going to have to take care of you on the back end. So there are a lot of things we can do without calling it a mandate, but to just make it almost impossible for people to live their lives without being protected and protecting the rest of us.
I'm having an out-of-body experience because I agree. So, and look, I mean, I grew up, my dad was, I'm the son of a pediatrician. I know you think I was going to say something else, but I was the son of a pediatrician.
No, others say that, Rob. Others say that.
The fact is, no child can show up at school this fall without showing their immunization, smallpox, and measles, et cetera. You got to make this familiar to people. Second is, and I think this is an important point, I would close the space in. Meaning if you want to participate in X, Y, or activities, you got to show you're vaccinated. So it becomes a reward punishment type system. You make your own calculation. The other thing is, I mean, the fact is there's data this week that like 30% of the healthcare workers are not vaccinated. Right. They got
to
lead by example.
Hard to imagine.
And the other thing that I think, if I my own recommendation, is that the religious community ecumenically across the board needs to speak up and encourage people. So you hit all populations with a singular message. And I do give credit to the White House of whether it's Fox TV, whether it's Republican leaders, getting a chorus of voices across the spectrum, not just political, religious, business, et cetera, with a singular message of why this is the right thing, and then lead by example. I still get back this, that 30% of the medical profession not vaccinated is an unbelievable wrong example that gives people a permission slip. The nurse isn't, the doctor isn't, or the pharmacist isn't. Why am I doing it?
It's a really good point. And in New Jersey this week, a hospital system fired 5 employees who refused to get vaccinated. Healthcare employees who refuse to get vaccinated. They're making it mandatory for employment now, a number of the hospital systems in New Jersey. And I think that's part of the way that we're going to lead 2 years. Employers, when the summer is over, employers are going to want people coming back. JP Morgan's announced they want people coming back. Goldman Sachs said they want to come back. And I think what will follow is those employers are going to say, if you want to come back in the office, which you have to do, you have to be vaccinated.
The problem, though, is
and I agree. I think it's key that non-political people speak up more, whether it's the medical profession, whether it's educators, whether it's just ordinary people. You know, George, when I received my vaccine, I went to a senior citizen public housing project in Washington, D.C. I told everyone I did not want to wait until I was 65, so I got in early. And I went door to door, similar to what I did when I was in politics, and I said, I'm getting a vaccine today. Will you join me? And they said, aren't you scared? I said, I'm scared to get the virus, especially back in the day when you got a virus when you had sex. I didn't want the virus. And so, you remember.
This is TMI.
I'm not admitting anything.
I was able to go door to door and convince people that it was okay, it was safe.
You gotta
have to lead by example.
So if you get the vaccine, you're so far less likely to go to the hospital, so far less likely.
And they don't want to hear from politicians, George.
That's why they
don't. These focus groups, whether it was President Bush 43 or President Obama, they said, what do they know?
Yeah, but
these folks responded. So I think politicians have to say what they need to say, but they're not the persuasive ones. It's the medical community and people who have had COVID.
And the religious
community. Tell them what it's like to have it. That's what's important.
I want to switch topics. Rahm, I'm listening to Speaker Pelosi and Rob Portman, and even though he says they're 90% there on a bipartisan infrastructure deal in the Senate, it seems almost impossible for this to go anywhere if the position of the Speaker is that it's not going to be put on the floor until after reconciliation. Are we going to have a stalemate?
No, I think, first of all, I want to compliment Rob Portman, the Republicans, and the leaders, the bipartisan group, against a lot of headwind. And I'm not just talking about the infrastructure and the difference, but a lot of headwind about bipartisanship to accomplish this. And I, look, if you're 90% of there, you're going to get there. I have confidence they're going to get
there. But is that the end of the road?
No. No, it's not the end of the road, but it's a major leap forward. And also, the other thing that's important, which is not only are people, break this down, people are unbelievably supportive about the investment in broadband, water infrastructure, and the roads, rails, and runways. They're unbelievably supportive of the bipartisanship, and they're doing it without raising the gas tax. As you know, I used to say in Chicago, throw me into that briar patch. And this will move also, in, and I think what the speaker's doing is negotiating. And that's okay to do, but it won't endanger the process and the accomplishment.
What's so fascinating to me is who they're negotiating with is actually the left flank of the Democratic Party. And I've been so struck, I think you saw that with Nancy Pelosi, I think you see this with Chuck Schumer. It is very difficult for them to look at the far left of their party in the eye and say, you know what? The filibuster is just going to be dead for the next 2 years, but you can still have everything you
want. President Biden pretty much said it this week.
Biden said it. Manchin has said it. You can still get everything you want. We're just going to do it in two parts, and you need a little bit of patience. So we're going to pass this first bill and then hold it for a beat. We've got everything else you want, soft infrastructure and reconciliation. And if they could just be patient, they actually could get everything they wanted and give the president a win. I mean, do you want to hold the Senate in 2 years? Because it's going to be if there's some bipartisanship. And frankly, everybody's going to win for that. And that's like Ram said, we're all agreeing. The country wants the government to work.
They want to also hold the House in 2 years. And so therefore, she understands, and I think the speaker is well positioned to know all of her caucus, that the progressive members who represent millions of Americans, they want to see change not just in roads, rails, and bridges and so forth, but also some of the soft infrastructure programs that they campaigned on. So I think it's going to be a win-win, not just for bipartisanship, but for Democrats delivering for the
American
people.
So you're convinced that all the Democrats in the Senate hold together on reconciliation, even if the House, even if the Senate bipartisan bill hasn't been voted on in the House?
Well, it's going to be tough, but I think Chuck Schumer understands that he's going to have to pull them over.
This is where Speaker Pelosi is tone deaf, because if she continues to push in this direction, you're giving the Republicans no room to be bipartisan. If the Republicans are characterized not as making a bipartisan deal on infrastructure, which I think will be supported, but that they're supporting reconciliation by sitting by and giving the infrastructure bill, but letting the reconciliation bill go first, they're not going to do it.
Sure.
They're going to back out of it. They're going to lose the Republicans they have. And then they're going to wind up with a problem with Joe Manchin on top of it.
Yeah.
I understand. She thinks she has to negotiate on everything. And she thinks that she has to play this game all the time. But she's wrong on this one. You can't ask Republicans to be bipartisan. They come forth and do it in the Senate. And then say, oh, but wait a second.
They're not doing it on the debt ceiling.
No, but George, part of that is a symptom of this. They're saying, well, wait a second now. You want us to do the debt ceiling, too, before we do the infrastructure bill and before we do it? Show us that you're willing to be bipartisan with us.
The politics of both caucuses and both chambers are totally different.
Right.
But on the end of the day, the election in 2022, I know that's not far off. That's not far off for anybody in that chamber, and that's okay, is won in swing states by swing voters in swing districts. And then in that sense, bipartisanship is unbelievably popular as the content of the bill. The second thing is, I'll just tell one little story, anecdote. I remember when we were working on ACA, and Nancy Pelosi was really trashing the Senate health care bill. Mm. Then sat down and said, okay, we're going to pass it. So in my view, she has fundamental things that she has to speak up for her caucus. Otherwise, she's not the leader of it, as well as the leader of the chamber. And she's making clear of those things while something is happening in the Senate.
And are you confident, though, in the Senate side that Senator Manchin, Senator Sinema, others are going to vote for reconciliation in the end?
Am I?
Yeah.
Yes. Because in the end of the day, I think the most important thing Senator Manchin has said in the past 6 months was, I want President Biden to be a success. And therefore, that translates to me, based on whatever you got to work through the details, that's going to matter. Wow. And that's essential when you look at the type of investments that are there. And Manchin to date has been very clear about what he's going to get done and for the president. And I think both the bipartisanship on infrastructure as well as the contents of the reconciliation package.
You agree with that, Margaret?
I mean, I do. Manchin's a senator from West Virginia. They need a lot of infrastructure spending. He understands that. He knows that. I think he's nervous about the price tag. Yep. But aside from that, why am I agreeing with you so much?
It's okay. Well, you're having
I think the key with Manchin is going to be, what is the number?
Yeah.
I don't think he's going to agree to $3.5 trillion. I don't think he will. I think he thinks it's too big and too much.
Well, he has to get something in his negotiations.
Yeah, but
that's right. So
it was $6 trillion before.
Joe Manchin's smart. He knows it was never $6 trillion.
Right. Well,
okay?
It's gone down.
It was never $6 trillion, and he's not going to agree. I don't believe he's going to agree to $3.5 trillion. It's going to be something less than that. But will he ultimately vote for reconciliation? I think he will, unless Chuck Schumer decides to say it's $3.5 trillion or nothing. If he says it's $3.5 trillion or nothing, Joe Manchin's going to go nothing.
Everybody look, there's a process in the legislative process where you get close to the edge, you look over and go, and you run back.
Don't want to
fail.
That's
why the infrastructure deal is the cost of failure is more politically and economically than the price of success. And that's what will drive people towards it. The politics of success outweighs the politics of no.
Boy, point of agreement here on the roundtable, so let's move on.
Let's get to some of them.
Margaret, I was struck by Pierre's piece there on violence all across the country. We're seeing rising gun violence in every state in the country right now, especially in the cities, as Pierre pointed out. And it's combined with what we talked about at the top of the show there in that poll. Huge pessimism, rise in pessimism among the American people right now.
Yeah, no, it's really striking, and I really hope we can get some infrastructure done so they have a win on the board for some bipartisan legislation actually at the federal level as well. Because, 90% of Americans agree there's some basic things we can all do with respect to gun control. And there are some even reform Republicans out there who are trying to think through what a futuristic Republican agenda can look like that includes some kind of gun control. It's not taking away anybody's guns, it's not hitting the Second Amendment, but there are things that can be done. And that are reasonable things that aren't going to hit Republicans. And so, you know, I look forward to it. None of it's going to happen if this polarization in Washington continues to have a chokehold on us. And so you got to have a little bit of a win on infrastructure. And then there's a lot of things that I think can be done. And, you know, I think there's a lot of hope for this administration that we might see some of that.
Look, I think while we focus and say gun violence, it's all in strategy. And you got to flood the zone. You got to flood the zone with after-school, summer jobs, mentoring programs. You got to flood the zone with precision policing. You got to flood the zone with economic development. You got to give a place that is filled with despair a sense of hope and opportunity. And way too many, one of the things that struck me with Pierre's story, two things. Way too many kids are going to school thinking about their safety and not their studies, because violence is more familiar in the sound of gunfire than the sound of laughter. And that is just an entire life lost meaninglessly to gun violence. The second thing he said, at least in urban, I can't speak to rural, that a few individuals and our overwhelming factor of the gun violence. There's like 5,000 individuals in any city, 2,000 individuals, who are creating both 75% of the problem. Those individuals do not belong on the streets where children are playing. That's simple.
George, and this is where the police reform issue is a really important issue to get done, because what's happening right now is police are on their heels. The atmosphere that's been created in this country are putting police on their heels. Now, this is not to say that there aren't some reforms that need to be done, and we did those when I was governor in New Jersey. They need to be done and can be done and be effective. But the only thing that's going to stop those 2,000 people and get them off the streets are police. And right now, we're not supporting police. And the way to support police is to work with them to reform what's going on. Violence de-escalation among police forces, community policing that gets them involved with the community, so the community and police are working together to stop what's happening in the streets. And that's what we need to do. And we're not doing it. And if we don't empower police, this violence is going to continue to go up. And I don't think there's people in any neighborhood in this country who want to see that happen. And so we've got to lower the rhetoric that's going on, that's been anti-police rhetoric across this country, that's wrong. You want to reform things? Absolutely. And we can and should. But we're not doing that. And as long as we don't do that, violence is going to continue to go up, because they're it.
It's more than just more police. We do need more police. And many of the police departments around the country, they've lost policemen. And that's one of the reasons why I think President Biden has urged some of the mayors and governors to use some of the money from the rescue plan to bring back more policemen, hire them, train them. But George, this has to be a comprehensive approach. It's not just more policemen. We got to get the community involved. You're absolutely right. We know, I mean, I can tell you right now, being a DC resident, and when I go home, you know where the pockets are. These are kids who are returning back to the streets. There's nothing to keep them busy, occupied. They have substance abuse. They have no jobs. It's despair. And it's frustrating as a city resident to see the kind of violence that we're experiencing across the board. The police are stripped. Trust me, I talk to my cops. Yep. I know my cops in the 4th District. I know them in the 2nd District when I go over to Georgetown. I know them everywhere across the city, but they're stressed out, and they need people in the community to help them.
And Don, that's why this defund the police rhetoric that's been coming out of parts of it is, but this is damaging. It is very damaging.
Here's the one thing. We're doing both sides of this wrong. We're policing at a community, not with the community.
Right.
And we're doing police reform at police, not with police.
Exactly.
That is going to have to be.
We have to work together. Right. Got to work together.
Time for this, I'm afraid we don't. That is all for us today. Thanks for sharing part of your Sunday with us. And before we go, Pierre Thomas's investigation with our partner stations across the country that tracks 1 week of gun violence in America is going to be airing across all ABC platforms this week. One Nation Under Fire takes a deep look at the human cost of this relentless trend and explores the root causes of violence and offers unique insight into the victims and communities devastated by these shootings. You can see his exclusive reporting on GMA, Nightline, and ABC News Live, and I'll see you tomorrow on GMA.
Now, when it matters most, the straightforward facts. ABC News is America's number one news.